This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Fozia Kasinja is the first woman to be granted political asylum by U.S. federal immigration officials in order to avoid undergoing female genital mutilation. In 1994, at the age of 17, she fled her native country, Togo, after she was forced into an arranged marriage that would have required her to submit to genital mutilation. This is a tribal rite still practiced in 26 African nations, in which parts of the female genitalia are removed. Kasinja traveled to the United States hoping for political asylum, but instead was imprisoned when she arrived at Newark International Airport. The U.S. Immigration Service held Kasinja in detention for more than a year and a half while waiting for her case to be heard and then appealed. Kasinja was finally granted asylum in June of 1996. Her case has set a legal precedent for other women seeking political asylum in this country, in that it redefines what qualifies as persecution. Fozia Kasinja has co-written a book about her experiences with Layli Miller Bashir, one of the lawyers who argued in her first trial. It's called Do They Hear You When You Cry? Terry Gross spoke with both of them last week. First, Terry talked with Fozia Kasinja about her personal story.
Fozia, I know your parents didn't believe in genital mutilation. Why not? Why were they opposed to it?
Well, my father, he really disagreed with the practice of the female genital mutilation when he was growing up. And it's because of their pain he saw his sister went through when she had the procedure done to her. And when he asked his mother, the answer was not satisfying to him, because she told him that this is something that our ancestors did, so we have to continue to honor that. And he didn't find that to be really a really convincing answer to him, for him to say that he would do such things to his children someday. And also my mother, who is from a different country, also her mother didn't believe in that tradition, and her father also didn't, even though in the tribe she comes from, they practice the procedure of FGM, but her parents also didn't agree with that practice. So none of my parents really believe or agree with the practice of female genital mutilation.
I think your aunt, your mother's sister,
she went through the procedure after her first husband died, and she had she was about to remarry, and the man that was going to marry her demanded that she go through the procedure, and because she needed husband, and according to my culture, you're supposed to do what the husband says, and since she wants to respect the choice of the husband, so she has to do whatever he says. So that's why she went through, and then she died of tetanus.
Tetanus.
Tetanus. And also my father, the reason why he really opposed it was because he saw the pain his own sister went through when she had it done to herself. So from then on, he swore not to have it done to any of his children.
Your father died when you were 16. He had a severe asthma attack. And then his brother and sister-in-law, your aunt and uncle, took over control of the family. How did they end up having more of a voice in your life than your mother did?
Well, yeah, it's still part of our culture or the tradition. When a father or a husband dies, his children or the whole of his property becomes the property of his family, his side of the family. They will decide whether they will let their wife stay there, or she has to go and live with her family. So it's really something that has been going on and on, and my mother has no choice since she came from a different country and a different tribe.
So your aunt and uncle, who took over control of the family, mm-hmm. They did believe in polygamy, they did believe in arranged marriages, they believed in female genital mutilation. And the year after your father died, your aunt told you one morning that you were going to be married that day to a man that she and your uncle had chosen. How did she tell you this? What did she say to you?
Well, the discussion about me getting married went on and on, and I kept resisting. I said, no, I don't want to do it. I don't want to get married. I don't want to be cut. And it kept going on and on until one day when she said, well, today. She called me into her bedroom, and I saw all this jewelry and the clothing and everything well arranged on her bed. So she said, well, these are your staff, and today is the day. And I just said, no, it can't be. And then she said, well, your husband wants you, and don't worry, you're going to be okay. The operation of the FGM is not going to take place today, so you have, like, few days to relax. So that's how she finally, like, broke the big information or the news to me.
The man who your aunt had chosen for you to marry was, I think, about 30 years older than you. Is that right?
Yeah. He was 45. I was 17. Yeah, sort of.
Okay. And he also already had three wives, so you would have been his
fourth
wife. Your parents didn't believe in polygamy, but your aunt and uncle did. You even got to meet his three other wives.
Yes.
What was it like to meet them? What did they tell you about what to expect?
Meeting them was annoying, for one thing. And also, they tried to pretend as if they're happy to have me in their household. Because they were like, oh, yeah, this is our beautiful bride. Oh, yeah, I'm happy. And the third wife, she was so happy that because when I come or I go along with them, I'm going to be the one to take over her job, like cleaning of the household and doing going to the market and cooking. So she will have somebody to take over her job. So that's one thing for her that she has to be really happy about. And the first wife, actually, she was more serious, and she told me the rules of the house, telling me how to respect my husband. If I respect him, he's going to love me, and I should respect her the most. And if anybody bothers me, I should come to her and tell her what's going on. So she was playing, you know, the role more like my mother and telling me that I have to respect her like I respected my mom. I have to respect my husband like I did my father. So it was really annoying, and actually I didn't pay any attention to them. You know, I just ignored them, and they were really going on and on and pretending to be, I don't know if they were really happy, but to me, I think they were pretending to be happy to have me in their household, because I don't know how or why a woman would be really happy when her husband is having another wife.
The marriage ceremony took place, and then the circumcision was supposed to happen
shortly, a
couple of days after that.
Yeah.
Tell me what the marriage ceremony was like.
Well, it was boring. It wasn't like the normal marriage ceremony we used to have in the community. It was really, really sad. It was more like a funeral.
Because more like a funeral?
Yeah, to me, because it was supposed to be my wedding day, but all I did was cry. I wasn't happy. And we didn't have any activities like we used to have when there was a really happy marriage. None of my mother's family were invited. And actually, the people who came were like, you can count the people who came to the wedding, which is not what it's supposed to be like. All the things that were supposed to happen during the ceremony didn't happen, except for having me dressed up and the dye we dye in on my feet and my hands. Even we did that, but besides that, none of the marriage procedures went according to the way it's supposed to be.
There was a traditional woman who came to help you on your wedding day. The Nashan, you pronounce that for me.
Nachene.
Yes. What is her role in performing the marriage rituals?
That's what she does for a living. So she doesn't have like any role in my family or something. She's just someone that my aunt hired to come to the house and help me. She did the ritual bathing for the marriage. And she also helped with the dyeing of the thing we call lele, which is a dye that we make the design on my feet and my hands. And she helped me get dressed. And she also does the female genital mutilation.
Did she or did your aunt explain why it's done and explain why this would, in their opinion, be a good thing for you and for your husband?
The reason why they do the female cutting is because they believe that the female clitoris is as equal to the male's organ. So when it's not cut, the woman is considered as a man. So no man will marry her. So it's more like a man marrying a man. So in order to make her a woman, she's supposed to be cut. And also, they believe that a woman is not supposed to have a very strong sexual pleasure. It's only the men who's supposed to have any pleasure during intercourse. And also, it helps to calm the woman down. She'll be like the perfect wife. When the husband tells her to sit, she has to sit, and she doesn't have to be really outgoing. And also, if they do it to before like purification date. Is that how I say it? Like before
purification day?
Yeah, before that, they believe the girl wouldn't be really like she wouldn't be prostitute. She wouldn't, because she won't have any sexual desire. So there's no way she's going to like being with men before her marriage. So it's more like to keep the girl a virgin until she's married.
Now, the way you escaped was your oldest sister had gotten you a plane ticket out of the country. She arranged a ride to secretly get you to the airport. And while your aunt was briefly away, your sister snuck you out to the airport with the help of this driver, got you onto the plane, and you were out of the country. You must have been mentally completely unprepared to leave home. I mean, you had never even been on a plane before.
Yeah, it's really strange because sometimes, even still, when I sit down to really think about what happened and how I got here, if anybody asks me to go back and do it all over again, no, I don't think I'll do that again, because I think I took a very severe chance or serious chance by doing that, because I left without knowing where I was going, and all I knew was, well, God is watching over me, so I know I'll be okay.
Well, you ended up for a while in Germany.
Yes.
And in Germany, you met a man who I believe was from Nigeria.
Yes.
Who sympathized with the position you were in and said that you should really go to the United States and ask for political asylum. And he sold you a passport so that you'd have a passport to get out of the country, even though it wasn't yours. And he said, when you get to America, tell them it's not really your passport and that you want political asylum.
That's right.
What did you expect the authorities would say after you made that little speech?
Well, I was expecting the officer that I'll talk to be sympathized, because from my point of view, I said, well, any human being that hears about what happened to me, the person will sure sympathize. And then the person will say, oh, well, yeah, I feel like I know where you're coming from. Oh, yeah, I feel your pain. So when I got here and everything really twisted around, I said, oh, my God. So I wasn't expecting to go through what I went through.
So you were put in detention while awaiting a hearing for asylum, and you were shocked to find out that your hearing was scheduled for 6 months later, meaning that you'd be in prison for 6 months, just waiting for the trial. What was the hardest part of prison life for you?
Wow. We can't name all the parts, because obviously all the 16 months that I stayed in jail were all hell. I can't say, oh, this is the fun day I ever had in jail. All the days were the same. And one thing is, even the way a fellow human being will talk to you will make you feel like nothing. She makes you feel like human animals. They talk to us like animals. And they make you feel like, they want you to really feel like the most humiliation day of your life. And they really succeed, because each moment at the prison makes you feel like nothing. Like, why do I ever exist? You know, from the way even the prison guards treat us.
My guest is Fozia Kasinja. She's received political asylum in the U.S. to avoid undergoing female genital mutilation in her native country, Togo. She has a new memoir called Do They Hear You When You Cry? We'll be back with Kasinja and the lawyer who argued her case, Layli Miller-Bashir, after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fozia Kasinja, and she was the first woman to get political asylum in the United States on the national level, in a national court, on the grounds that she was escaping female genital mutilation. Also with me is Layli Miller-Bashir, who co-wrote Fozia Kasinja's new memoir and also handled a lot of her political case. Layli Bashir was a law student at the time the case started. Layli, let me ask you how you first found out about Fozia's case and why it was important for you to get involved with it.
Well, Fozia's case meant a great deal to me because the issue of female genital mutilation was something that I had been exposed to through visiting my family who live in Gambia, West Africa. And it was just an issue that I was very, very interested in throughout law school. I wrote papers on the subject and I had studied it from a legal as well as social and medical perspective. It was really quite fortuitous that I had studied this issue. I had just finished writing a law journal article on it. And then I began a summer job where I was a law clerk in an immigration office who happened to get Fauzia's case. My boss, having seen that I had some background in this area, really gave me her case to handle, and that's how I got it.
What did you do to help organize a case around Fauzia?
Well, at the beginning stages, I helped to write the brief. I did the legal research involved in arguing her case. And then when it came to the day of the hearing, I was the person who argued on her behalf, who asked her the questions, allowing her to tell the story. And I represented her before the immigration judge. When we lost, I felt a very sincere commitment to her and this issue generally. I was very emotionally affected by the whole experience. I think perhaps partly because it was my first. It was the first time I had been in court. And it was very traumatic for me. I think being an American and believing that we have a great system of justice, I was a little naive, I think, going into the courtroom. And I was very, very shocked by what I saw and the insensitivity, the lack of compassion, the quickness with which she was judged and her claim was disbelieved. And felt really quite passionate about making sure that she would not be sent back to Togo. So after her hearing, I left actually for the Beijing conference, the United Nations Women's Conference in Beijing, 2 days after her hearing, and there was really able to talk to a lot of women who were involved in this issue and galvanized support. When I returned to the United States, I approached the Human Rights Law Clinic at American University and asked them to take her case on a pro bono basis. I knew her cousin was running out of money who had been helping in her legal representation. I also knew that perhaps she could get even better legal representation through a university or another law firm. So I approached them. They agreed to take the case, and I continued to work on her case and advocate on her behalf as a law student.
Lily, the immigration law says that an individual can be granted asylum based on a well-founded fear of persecution because of race, religion, nationality, political opinions, or membership in a social group. What was your argument that she was a member of a persecuted group?
Well, I argued that she was a member of a particular social group, and that social group consisted of being a woman, rejecting the practice of female genital mutilation and belonging to a tribe that practiced it and having no protection against it. So it involved several different elements that comprised this social group category. I think it's important to point out, and this is really part of the reason that Fauzia's case is so important, traditionally, historically, in our refugee laws, we haven't granted asylum to people because of types of persecution that are inflicted on them because of their gender. We look to things like political opinion and race and religion, and traditionally those have been the bases for becoming a refugee. And the type of persecution that we had historically recognized wasn't the type that was often inflicted on women. That was seen as personal, not persecution. But Fauzia's case helped to change that. As a result of her case, women can now seek asylum in the United States because of a type of persecution that's inflicted because of gender, like female genital mutilation. Actually, a recently handed down case came down just the other week where a woman was granted asylum because of a practice called troikasi, which is a form of ritual slavery on women and girls. This woman was from Ghana. These girls serve as payment for crimes that their family members have committed. And she was granted asylum in the United States, and the legal basis for doing that was Fauzia's case. It was cited as such in the decision.
Fauzia, what is your life like now in the United States, now that you've been granted political asylum, you're out of prison? What are you doing with your time? What are your hopes for the future?
Well, the first thing I did was to go back to school. So I was out of jail in April, and in June of 96, I started going to school. So I've been in school ever since that time. I was in the community college in Alexandria, Virginia, and actually, this semester, I took the semester off because I'm on a tour for this book, so I couldn't take any classes.
Fauzia, when you fled Togo, you weren't able to consult with your mother first because your mother basically been more or less pushed out of the family when your aunt and uncle took over after your father's death. When were you able to talk with her again and explain to her what had happened and where you were and why you'd fled?
Yeah, that was really hard because when I was in Germany, I wrote to my sister to tell her where I was, and I never got any reply from her. And when I finally made it to the United States, I wrote to them again. And then my mom and my sister, all my family sent me a photo in a prison. And then I didn't, when I wrote to them, I didn't tell them I was in prison. And my cousin, who had contact with my sister, always told them that, oh, Fauzia is fine, she's okay. And I also wrote to them and I told them I was in a place more like a boarding house, so they have nothing to worry about. So when I was really finally let out of jail, I called her and I tried to explain to her where I was then, and she really couldn't stand. She couldn't hear, and she really begged me not to tell her. And she all that matters is that I'm okay now, and I should worry about it. And she apologized to me about what happened to me, and she really begged me not to tell her what happened because that would really kill her.
Does she think you did the right thing in fleeing?
Yeah, she did, and she. Actually, she apologized to me that I had to go through that all the time because she felt like, well, she's sorry she couldn't do anything to help besides having me leave the country. And so she thought, she thinks I've did something really great, but she still thought I didn't have to go through that. So she always said, for example, I'm sorry that you have to go through this. I'm sorry. And so she kept apologizing. I told her I'm okay.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Oh. Terry Gross speaking with Fauzia Kasinja and Layli Miller Bashir. Their new book is Do They Hear You When You Cry? I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.